Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So
like
you could just see
$600,000 deducted.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." Oh, man. He said, this woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. Mm-hmm. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government, plus I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing, and I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. Mm. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven, the radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this, because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So, if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
All right, today, our jump-off title is Friday, and I'm shaping up a mini e-book. I got it all formatted. Well, I outlined it about 3 or 4 days ago. What's for Friday? Yeah. I outlined it real quick, like on Monday, then added on to the outline, because I want to have it limited where you can read it in one setting. It's like it basically concentrates on just one idea, and then you do a problem, then you take that one idea. Here's the process, the strategy, something that you put it where it'll be probably no more than about 10 pages. That's why we call it a mini ebook. But anyway, but in the process, I ran across something on, I forgot, YouTube or Facebook. Learn a skill, because some people, and for some of us, you might need to learn new skills, and then you might have to learn two or three new skills. So, one skill, and some people might not think of it as a skill, is baking bread. I remember my grandmother, I lived with my grandparents for like a year when I was like in second grade and down in New Orleans. And my grandmother would bake bread, man, probably a loaf a week. And I just remember, man, that smell going all through the house, because it smells delicious. then it come out the oven, and then you get a slice of that hot bread, man, out the oven. So, anyway, some months ago, maybe last year, I ran across a YouTube video of a guy in Uganda who became a billionaire through the skill of baking bread. Something as simple as baking. I mean, there's a gazillion videos on YouTube on how to make your own bread, bake your own bread. But he became a billionaire by learning that skill. His name is Amos, and I might be butchering his last name, N-Z-E. That's spelled N-Z-E-Y-I. I might be mispronouncing that. Amos N-Z-E, or N-Z-E. Amos N-Z-E. I'm going to see if I can get an audio. But let's read. I'm going to see if I can get an audio and play it for you guys during this podcast. Anyway, Amos N-Z-E is a Ugandan businessman, entrepreneur, and industrialist. He is one of the wealthiest people in Uganda. He was born in 1947, so he's 76, 77 years old. And he's still active. And you can go, let's go to it right now. His, if it's not his flagship business, Hot Loaf Bakery. Hot Loaves Bakery. And all right, now let me make sure I got the right one. Because there's Hot Loaves Bakery and there's Hot Loaves Bakery. Okay, how did they? All right. Let's look up Hot Loaf, because that's where they have a Hot Loaf Bakery. All right. There's a distinction here in spelling. All right, if you go to Facebook, all right, on Facebook, there's Hot Loaf, L-O-A-F, Bakery, which is in Kampala, Uganda. Okay, now, on that, yeah, go, all right, wait a minute. All right, let me see if I can go to a website. Hot Loaf Bakery. Or they have Hot Loaves Bakery. Hold on, let me put Uganda on here. All right, this might be the, okay. All right, well, let's say that, well, these are both in Kampala. It might be one of the same. It is open, but of course, Uganda's some miles ahead of where I'm at. They're closed at 6 p.m. Ugandan time. Let's see if they have the same phone number. All right, it's the same one. All right, on Facebook, it's listed as Hot Loaf Bakery Limited, LTD. But the website is Hot Loaves Bakery. Okay, all right, one's a .com and one's a .ug, which UG is Uganda. But anyway, this guy learned the skill of baking bread and became a billionaire. Amos N-Z-E. Matter of fact, let's see. I will. Okay. What I will attempt to do is I want you to hear him speak. So we're going to play an audio here while I arrange to get that. Oh, wait a minute. Okay. Let me play Ballin' on Baltic while I get this, at least attempt to get the video so I can play. I mean, audio so you can hear him speak. Skillet of the day. Well, probably because I'm into solar cooking. That's one of my hobbies. And you can solar bake bread as well. So we'll have classes on how to solar bake bread. That's how to make it at home as well.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. I mean, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 a piece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She drug you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't hurt himself.
You from New State.
It's over. When I say it's over, everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it. Let's go across the street.
I ain't caught it. I'll slap the fuck out of one of y'all.
Real quick. Just like this one as well.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it. Because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you. Because then you can do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns. Because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations, like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield.
Okay. All right. We have some success here. All right. We're talking about learning the skill. We're going to play You Can Hear From a Billionaire's Mouth, Amos Nzee. And he's in Kampala, Uganda. He is a guy who learned the skill of baking bread and became a billionaire. You can't get any simpler than baking bread.
Desert Island Discs on 91.3 Capital FM.
91.3 Capital FM, Desert Island Disc series on a wonderful Sunday evening such as this one. As usual, sharing with you life's interesting stories from ordinary folks with extraordinary ways of how they have been raised to where they are. Today, I have an extraordinary gentleman, a man that has done it all, seen it all, and is more than just willing to share with us his life story. Many of you have possibly caught a bit of him in more ways than one, possibly taken a drink of one of his products, or even eaten a sumptuous meal from what he has made for us. Today, we hear his own life story from his own mouth. Welcome to the program, Mr. Amos Nzee.
Thank you. May I remove this?
I will appreciate if you do for
audibility. How many meters between me and you?
This is about 1 meter and a few inches. I think we are safe.
That's what is recommended?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
We appreciate. Thanks for the kindness and thanks for keeping the SOPs intact. So, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And we're here to know who you are, when you are born, where you are born. But first and foremost, we know that you're the chairman of, you know, Pepsi-Cola beverages that we enjoy here in Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
Well, many of us also recall you from eating the first locally made bread here when bread was such a scarce commodity that we're importing it from neighboring countries. Kotlof it is. Tell me, how are all those two ventures faring?
They're going on very well.
Mm-hmm.
They have grown from small to big. Yes.
And later on in the program, you'll be telling us how you actually raised them from small to the big companies that they are today.
Maybe can we go back to your first question of where I was born?
That's
from.
Where we are headed right now, Chairman.
Hmm?
Yes.
Should I start with that?
Please do.
Thank you. I was born from Kabare, formerly known as Kigezi, the former Kigezi,
mm-hmm.
before they were divided into
the
three districts, Rukunjiri, Kisoro, and Kabare.
Mm.
So I was born in Kabare, raised up in Kabare, studied in Kabare.
Wow.
Whatever education I acquired. So I am really a Kabare person.
Tell us more about your parentage in Kabare. Who were your parents and what did they used to do? Were they businessmen like you? Were they local politicians? Were they royalty like kings? Who were they?
Kings?
Well, I'm told there's nothing like a king in Kabare. Everyone is a king in their own right.
No. My parents were simple people. My dad, yes, I knew my dad. I grew up with my dad. But unfortunately, I never saw my mother.
Oh, dear.
Yes. I don't even have... I've got a small picture which they took, which was in black and white. It's a miserable picture, but yes, I see her face, how she looked like, but the picture was poorly done. I was sold in first born when I was 3 months old.
Oh, dear.
So that part I don't really, I cannot say, talk much about my mom. But I can talk about my dad because he became my dad and mom.
Oh, dear. That's
and he brought me up very well. He tried. My father was not anybody important in Kabare. Actually, he was the... Can I even describe him as a middle-class person? I don't want to call him poor.
Mm.
He was not poor. He was very rich at heart.
That's a good one.
So he was not poor. But earning very little income. He was working in a hotel known as White Horse Inn.
Oh.
The owner at the time was called Kishamaza.
Mm-hmm.
A Mzungu, a British.
That's a nice name for a British man.
And my dad used to take me there once in a while, maybe once in a blue moon, like twice in a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have a treat of, you know, cakes and tea and so forth. So that's where he was working. And if I can remember him telling me how much he was earning, I think it was 3 shillings.
One,
a month.
Two, three.
3 shillings per month.
In today's speak, how much would that be, you think, roughly?
You can divide it by 20 shillings a pound,
wow.
Each pound, or 70 shillings a dollar at that time, maybe.
Oh,
that's how you can
try. 7 shillings was $1.
Compute it to get.
So you'll have to get
amount.
3, 5. About 50,000. I don't know. My mathematics is not that very good after
it
so many.
It was very
years.
Literal, but you can imagine someone. Can I pause for some?
I'll be more than that. Thank you very much.
Can you imagine someone who was earning
enough.
That literal,
mm-hmm.
that much, and bringing up a family of 12 children?
You are.
On 3 shillings?
You are 12. Children, 12
yes.
Siblings, and you must have been the last.
When I was last in my mom's mother, and then he married another wife when I was 6.
Mm.
He waited for me to grow.
For you to first grow, yes.
Yes.
Oh, that was very
very, very kind to me.
Mm.
Because he was born again, he was saved.
Ah.
Barokole, serious Barokole. He was a churchman. And, you know, with that 3 shillings, he managed to put a few of us in school to a certain level. If you attained like primary 6, he would say go.
Start
and, you know, I start another one.
Where did he start you from? Did you go to church school since you were a born-again Christian?
I went to a church school called Rugwere Primary School. And that's where I met the now current Prime Minister.
Wow.
Dr. Ruhakana Rugunda. And that's where I met Honorable Mbabazi.
The former Prime Minister.
Yeah, former Prime Minister Mbabazi.
Uh-huh.
And then Mutebile, the governor.
Of the Bank of Uganda.
We were all in the same school in primary one together.
Same class?
Yes, same.
This must have been a very executive P1 class that is, has produced two prime ministers back to back.
A governor of the central bank and an astute businessman like yourself.
Oh, yes, it was. It was because when we go back to reflect on how we are doing, we always talk about it because we've been friends since that primary one. Up to now, we are one person. Okay, I'll tell you, I struggled a lot to study, which, of course, I didn't succeed to study and go very far. But I thank God for what, for whichever level I stopped at. I can tell you that in primary three, I remember very well I started doing business when I was in primary three to raise the money to pay for school fees.
Since you were about 19 years.
Yeah, I was about 7, 8. And I started selling eggs. And that's the worst business I've ever done in my life. No. I was selling my market. I was selling to teachers. And the teachers were not being paid. I would wait 6 months to be to be paid for my eggs. This is not yesterday's situation. It goes back. Don't blame this government that are not paying teachers. It is, you know.
Teachers have always been underpaid, underpaid and not paid.
Exactly. I survived on that for some time. Then that business became, you know, became very poor, very bad business. And it drove me to doing something, think about doing something else. And I ended up in baking, what you can call Mwana Kava. You know Mwana Kava? These small cakes. Yes. And again, I sold, you know, those mandazis were in primary 4, 5. And you know, that was very good business because my schoolmates were buying the mandazi. Yes. So I did that for a while. Later on, when of course there I had some, you know, problems of my sisters inviting me that they would pay for me. I went to very many schools.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? They would say, "Come, we'll pay your school fees." But later on,
they
end up being a houseboy
in
their home. They use me as somebody to fetch water, then cook, then, you know, go to the garden to dig, to get, you know, food from there. And sometimes even not go to school. They would say, "Today you don't go to school because we are going to harvest sorghum." So I would miss school for about a week.
Because you're harvesting
sorghum. And so forth. So I would move now from this home. Another one to say, I will take you. So I went to very many schools.
Within Sirka Kigali.
Excuse me. Later on, I was invited when I was going to what was equivalent to senior one, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It was the primary 7 at that time. I was invited my brother to Kampala.
Oh.
Yes, so I got to Kampala, welcomed by my brother's wife, and I stayed then for about 3 months without going to school. Finally, he got to me school, Kororo High School. Then I had to wait because they had, you know, they were demanding that you must be white, you must put on
a white shirt, white trousers,
even shoes, everything, the socks. What I remember actually. I enjoyed that uniform.
Chairman, I will cut you short right there and remind you that on this program, we play our music. Right about now, we will allow you to play your first song so that we first get this image of you in Kampala in all white, first sinking, and then we can continue with your lifestyle. So what will be your first song?
Okay, maybe Babirye, Judith Babirye, Wanjagara.
Wanjagara.
Yes.
What do you like about that song?
Wanjagara, yes, Wanjagara, you know.
Yeah, God.
Now Kuwachi. You loved me, God. What will I give you? Does it make sense?
A lot of it.
Yeah, he played that song on my son's wedding, Humphrey,
mm-hmm.
in the Calvary.
Mm.
And everybody in the church, even the president was there.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody liked the, you know, Babidi's song.
The Honorable Judith Babidi's song, Wanjaga, was chosen by Chairman Amason Zeyi, an astute businessman, sharing with us his life story on Desert Island Discs. You will agree with me, this seems to be going the direction of grass to grace. We'll be right back.
Desert Island Discs on 91.3 Capital FM.
Welcome back. It's the Desert Island Discs. And yes, we're still listening to the life story of Chairman Amason Zeyi, who, by all standards, is an astute businessman. So here you are. You mm-hmm. have arrived at Kololo High School. Mm. You're required to wear all white.
All white.
Take us.
I did not really last longer. School fees again.
Another challenge of school.
Yes, yeah, so the gain I got there was the uniform only. I cannot say again anything, knowledge, nothing at all from Kololo High School.
You just got a white uniform.
Just got my uniform, but now wait.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, again in Kampala, I became a businessman.
Did you know anyone?
Selling medicine.
Medicine?
Medicine. I had an uncle who was a cousin, first mm-hmm. cousin, working in Murago Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
He passed on. Yeah. And there were these tablets, double color.
Double color?
Yes.
Tetracycline capsules.
Ah, double color. The cure for gonorrhea. Okay? Now I started trading in those double color. I made good money.
Because gonorrhea was very prevalent?
It was very, you know, at rampant. You know, it was everywhere. And you know, these drivers, like the drivers who gave me lift.
Hey, the truck drivers?
Yes.
Every
I knew where they were parking.
Uh-huh.
In Chivubu
uh-huh.
and at Top Life in Mengo.
Mm.
So I used to go there and sell it to them. Sell those double cars.
And you made money?
And I made not, of course, too much money, but mm-hmm. survival.
Survive, yes.
Yes, I would use it to go Mengo Murago, those buses.
Mm-hmm.
I used it to enjoy those buses. I went everywhere and Tete, just sitting there. Mengo Murago, I go through Kampala Road.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the shop, window shopping. Buy them in the bus, all those drapers, Fazarabudara.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So I would enjoy, you know, in those Mengo Murago, because they would be like every 10 minutes.
Wow.
Every 10 minutes. Then, very interesting, my brother he had the habit of reading newspapers, Uganda Agassi.
The big one, like
yes, Uganda Agassi. And in that paper, he had left it on a table.
Mm-hmm.
He went to work after finishing, you know, with it. He just dropped it on the table. So I landed on it and started also reading. Now, inside there, I think on the business page, there was an article that Obote had inserted in contractors of those who were doing, those who had won road construction,
mm-hmm.
those companies. And this company happened to be WRD, Water Resources Development, from Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So, he had, you know, they had inserted in that agreement that they must employ school dropouts.
Oh, school dropouts?
School dropouts.
Must be employed in this.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in good time because
you had finished
it was like next month, the project.
Mm-hmm.
And these people, when I asked, they were already in Kabari, the Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
I again very quickly went to, you know, my friends, you know. This time I didn't go on top of the truck because they knew me
now.
They
now knew you.
As they were my customers.
So you carried a few double cars?
I carried it even some I gave for free. They took me back to Kabale.
Uh-huh.
So when I go to Kabale, I was, I think, number 6 to be employed.
What were they going to do again?
They were going to construct a road from Kabale to Ntungam.
Oh, the Kabale Ntungamo road?
Yes, I had all the qualifications as a school dropper.
Yes. You had it.
So I was about number 6 to be employed.
Wow.
And I started now making good salary.
What were you employed to do exactly?
The first employment was boy spanner.
What's a boy spanner?
Boy spanner, you help mechanic.
Uh-huh.
He tells you, give me 12.
You know 12.
It's called number 12.
Yeah, number 12. You bring it.
You say, give me a screwdriver, you bring it.
Give me a car.
Give me a prize, you bring it.
Why? There's something called why.
You bring it.
Mm-hmm.
So you become like, you know, a
messenger, but we.
a conduit between someone who is doing mechanics
and the store.
And you are just. But you have to watch if you are a clever person. Because I was very attentive and watching properly.
Mm-hmm.
Then I was also, promoted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? To mechanic?
To a mechanic.
Wow.
But a mechanic in a field of managing compressors, Rolls-Royce compressors. Mm-hmm. These Rolls-Royce compressors, they are the ones you use to bring down mountains. Like those mountains in Kabale, those hills, when you are going, to climb and then you come down to Kabale. Some of those were brought up down by myself. So I was liked. Then the engineer brought me nearer to his department, the chief engineer, by the name of Jacob.
You remember the name?
Yes, I remember, of course. I can never forget
that
Jacob.
That means that man made an
impact. Because he promoted me from, I started earning, what amount was I think 65 cents per hour.
65 cents per hour.
Yes. And he brought me to about 1 shilling 65 cents. By the time, we finished in Tungamo. No, before we finished in Tungamo, then Jacobo was not a graduate. He was a practical person.
Mm.
He did not go to university to become an engineer. He was competing with other engineers. They had started in Mbarara Katunguru. But the engineer there, who was actually highly qualified with many degrees, he failed to manage the machine.
Mm-hmm.
So they invited this Jacob to come there. I usually go with him. We would repair those tractors. You know, you find the engineer has said, remove the engine. But when we would go there to inspect those tractors, Jacob would look at them, he would say, bring the mirror, bring the torch, open this cover, crankshaft. He sees the chain. He says, no, this one you don't have to remove the engine. You have to, this is where the problem is. Would fix it very quickly and go back to Kabale. So eventually, we operated the two sites, two roadworks.
Mbarara Katunguru, which is on the Kasese Road. And
yeah, then eventually Tungamo we finished, and now we moved to Mbarara. We moved to Mbarara. I stayed in Mbarara. I remember this Gordon Wavamunu.
Mm-hmm.
He had the dry cleaning, and he had some mizigo there,
some
small rat. I rented one of his mizigo.
Did you ever meet him?
Yes.
Oh, you were using.
He's my friend. Wavamunu, I didn't know then.
At that time,
he was a big man.
You couldn't meet him. You wouldn't.
No,
as
I
landlord,
wouldn't.
You
I would, meet the managers. And stuff. But wait a minute. I had met him before at the taxi park. He was a driver, driving a small Volkswagen. Because I had also.
Oh, by that time
he drove me. Yeah. Yeah, he drove me. He was a taxi driver. He had a small. This customer. He's come also from very far.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So then, now you're in Mbarara, you are renting one of the mizigos belonging
to
Wavamunu.
Yes, now I had been saving a lot of money. I had saved quite a bit of money. And my ambition was to start by to be self-employed. That was everything I was doing. I was doing it temporarily. I didn't want to work for anybody. And 3 years I worked, that was the last time.
Tell me.
I worked only for 3 years. I was in employment for 3 years. I resigned when we were in a place called Nkombe. Nkombe is where former chief just comes from.
Having now heard your life story and how you have juggled so many things and that ambition to become self-employed, I think let's play your next song. Then when we return, we now begin the journey of your self-employment.
But Simon, I'm not very good actually at music. I don't have time for music. But I can maybe, Ebyejinsi n'umushenyi.
which is a
hymn. That's a nice, good one.
Which, by the way, in English, it means that all that there is in this world is quicksand. So it's like an old hymn from the Anglican Revival times.
Mm.
And I'm glad that you picked it up. Why do you say all that there is sand? Yet you have worked so hard and are still working even today. Why do you call it sand?
Because at the end of the day, you leave everything.
That's a good philosophy.
You're not going with anything.
Let's play that hymn, get ourselves into the Sunday mood, and of course reflect on our lives and know that whatever it is that we are toiling for today, we'll leave it all here, but it certainly leaves a legacy, and that's what I think Chairman Nze is doing. We'll be right back.
Desert Island Test on 91.3
Capital FM, Desert Island Disc Series, and yes, Chairman Amos Nze is sharing with us his life story. He is the chairperson of that beautiful beverage that you love to take, Pepsi Cola, the franchise in Uganda. He's a bottler. Hot loaf, if you've enjoyed bread and it's not hot loaf, you have not eaten bread at all. And now he'll be telling us exactly where it is that we are seated. He's also putting up something quite marvelous, and it will be quite something when he gets to complete it.
Of course, I cannot forget to promote our artists. I cannot really move away from, you know, appreciating Chameleon songs.
That now will become
Bariwa,
your
Bariwa.
Now that now we already have our third song.
Okay.
But before we play it, you now tell us that you woke up one morning after you have saved quite some money, had built a Mabati, had put Mabati on your father's roof, you had some tukas, you said, I quit employment. You went to start your own business.
Okay. So, when I quit the job of employment with the Israelis, I went into food, trading the food, buying food from Chinchizi, where it was cheap, and selling, supplying it to Kabale.
What kind of food are we talking about?
In schools in Kabale, hospitals in Kabale. These were, you know, fruits, sweet potatoes, Irish potatoes, katogo, everything. And how? I went, actually, I did the, you know, I don't know even how I managed to go deep and to buy gardens. I did to buy gardens of, you know, plantations.
You come and see, this is now sweet potatoes.
Yes, I go in the village. Mbabazi will tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Maybe even my, I could have bought from their place because his father was a very good farmer and a very rich in food. Mbabazi home, they had a lot of food. And but that was not actually the best business to earn enough money to buy trucks and so forth. Which direction now I will be taking it.
Tell me.
On the way to Chinchizi, you pass through the forest called Mafuga. Now in Mafuga, they were cutting. I saw many cutting. Those timber. Okay? And of course, what I did, they were using saws, you know? Manual.
Yeah, manual saws.
Yes. I used the saw there and look at them, I say, but then I started even asking them where they were selling the wood. They told me they would sell it to a small mill there. Of Karasinga. And I asked the price, then to compare, you know, then I said they are going to compare with the price in Kabale. Then I went to Kampala, I compared with Kampala prices. And a friend of mine called Alex Kahuzo, an engineer in National Housing Corporation. I approached him and said, I have timber. Can you buy? Said, yes, surprise me, we are looking for timber, cypress, pine, arubai. So, actually, what I did again, I invested in saws, automatic, you know, automation, automation. And I gave to these people, they started cutting for me because I needed so many trucks. Started hiring trucks, supplying national housing. There was a gentleman who was killed at Ximenti when they were, you know, during these wars that we have gone through.
Mm.
They were shot drinking at Ximenti there by the name Okao from Lango. Very nice man, highly qualified engineer. He liked my timber and the way I was honest in supplying correct running meters, which they, you know. And he gave me more business that even took me to Nakasongora, that barracks in Nakasongora. I supplied all the timber that I built that by that barracks.
That's interesting.
That barracks, I know it in and out.
Wow.
Yes, and all these national things, Excelcom, this is where the Prime Minister was before. Then the village ministers, the village, all those were my timber. And if I can remember very well, Right Honorable Kadaga was actually employed in that corporation, and he was the one measuring this timber, if I can remember very well. So that made me actually a big step or a big jump.
It gave you a very quantum leap.
Yes, because it made me buy trucks, these semi-trailers.
Wow.
Wrong trucks, you know.
The little boy from Kabai.
Yes, I owned about 3 or 4. Now, they started now the wars. When President Museveni attacked Mbarara.
But all this way, let me take you back a little bit. You were still running as a young bachelor, or somewhere along the way you had now?
No, I was a bachelor.
You had decided just to make money?
Yes. Until I was, I think, 26 years. That's when I got married. And that war of Mbarara, I think it was 1972.
Yes.
That attack. I remember actually I was going to Fort Potro with my pickup, and people came running from Mbarara to Ishaka.
That distance is,
yes,
over 30,
yes,
50 or something.
Yes,
like,
and
yes,
they were saying Kaijiri has been shot, what? Bananuka was shot, but I think it was not true. But I think they were arrested. Then then those trucks, my trucks, 3 trucks, they were confiscated by the army. They took them to Mutukura because now they were again trying to attack Tanzania through Mutukura.
Mm-hmm.
I met one gentleman in the army called he was a major, Major Mukiri. I had seen him in one of the bars. Odeon Cinema, I think it was. No, there was a bar in the cinema where I used to go. Odeon, I think.
Odeon Cinema, yes.
Odeon Cinema.
Uh-huh.
And Norman Cinema opposite.
Uh-huh.
So I requested him, I reported to him that my trucks had been confiscated. He said, okay, if you can give me something, I'll get them. I said, please, please. He got me the trucks.
The 3 of them?
Yes, yes, he got me the trucks. I got all of them, not at the same time, one after the other.
But in what shape did you find them?
Not really bad shape, because I don't think they had a chance to cross Mutukura. Nyerere couldn't
allow
them.
Mm.
So when I got them back, Mombasa, I had a friend of mine called Jirigori, he passed on. I gave him my trucks. They started working for him.
In Mombasa?
In Mombasa. And later on...
Because then you feared that the insurgency in Uganda may not allow them.
So I secured them. But I started now using people, you know, hiring. But these trucks now, they were passing here, going to Rwanda, going to Burundi, carrying, you know, materials.
Mm-hmm.
Because that guy was working for Transitra.
Mm.
He was transporting for Transitra as, you know, a contractor. Then did I tell you that I was a rider driver?
Now you started enjoying.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. When my, the money now
had
started
coming. My hard money now started now pulling it out.
Mm-hmm. So enjoy life, spiritual luxuries.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And I think I did very well in the riding.
Why of all
I was the champion in this country for quite a number of years. Now in 1975, Amin was elected as the chairman of OAU.
Mm-hmm.
Then Amin, when we were in a rally, in somewhere called, where was it? I think it was in Arua.
Mm-hmm.
He called the about four of us. I think it was Padebrick, Haji Junju, Haji Kawere, myself. He called us in the dining and started greeting us, saying that I don't want Muzungu to be the first one. And for him, he didn't know that the road to win it is not about being the first one on the road. It was the points.
The points, yes.
Yes. So whenever we were approaching,
mm-hmm.
I would be probably beating everybody, and I would come like number six. Oru Junju would be beating us,
but when
and I come number eight. But for him, he sees somebody who is number one on the road.
He knows that is the one.
He knows that is the one. But luckily enough, I used it to be most of the time. Competing between Impade Brick, Asa Brick, Junju Haji Kawere, Matovu. Yeah. So, I would be both beating them sometimes on the road and points.
Wow.
So that's why I was invited. Because remember, there was element of moving.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing I suffered, you know, when he said, I'm going now, I'm chairman of OAU. I'm going to have a rally of 6,000 kilometers. He said, I want you to go to Sudan, Congo, Rwanda, Burundi,
Tanzania,
Kenya, and come finish here. So, when these people went for route,
track route, they call it scrutinizing,
yes, scrutinizing, whatever. It came out to be 6,000 kilometers. Even having, it was like in 10,000 or whatever. They kept on, you know, cutting corners and, you know, chopping it. But they zeroed on 6,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, these Haji Kaweris and the Junju, they pleaded to him. They went to him and said, we need the cars, factory prepared cars, but we don't have foreign exchange. All we need is to be allocated foreign exchange. I mean, say, they give you. We were all sent to Bank of Uganda.
Mm-hmm.
I think we met Abbas Mawanda there. He's the one who gave us the money. She was in the Bank of Uganda as the director for exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And we got money and flew to London.
This was your money or government's money?
The money was ours. Foreign exchange was from government.
Ah.
So what the facility we got from government was to exchange our money.
The money.
And again, of course, it was a big advantage. If you could sell, say, $1,000, you'd get probably enough money to pay for $6,000, right, having sold $1,000.
Wow.
You'd collect enough money and buy on official. If you bought on official from Bank of Uganda, you'd get about $6,000.
Oh, that was a good killing.
Yeah, it was good. So I flew to London to someone called John Speed.
Mm-hmm.
He was preparing those cars. So I chose to buy Datsun 1800. And of course, once you buy it brand new, I bought it brand new from showroom in London.
Mm-hmm.
Then took it to John Speed. Now he has to open to dismantle it, even the engine, to put in, you know, to cut the engine block. And the 15 big piston mm-hmm. and the wings. Okay? To make the engine stronger and powerful.
That's interesting.
Then all those, you know, camshaft change,
mm-hmm.
you know, completely remodify the engine. And of course, they throw away the gearbox, they put in rock diff, special one. So I bought that car. We came here, we competed, the Kenyans, Tanzanians, what, Muzungus, Muyindis, Kalasingas. I emerged the winner of 6,000 kilometers.
My goodness.
Yes.
Isn't that the longest rally we've ever had in
this
country?
Yes, yes. I won that rally. And of course, you know what he had promised?
Mm-mm.
The winner. We are now, this time, we are now in Kabale. In another rally, he said, whoever wins the rally, this OEU rally, I'll give him a Mercedes-Benz 280. And his navigator.
Wow.
So me, I expected to get a Mercedes-Benz.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, again, you know, Amosi, who is Amosi? Ah, I ended up getting a Korean car called Pony. My name is Pony.
Not a Mercedes-Benz.
Now that Pony, I remember I had Ezra Munyezi with me. He was excited that I had won. He accompanied me to pick it from Munyonyo.
Mm-hmm. Vira.
Cape Town Vira. That's where we got the prizes. So I got the Pony, which I appreciated, brand new. My navigator, Bari Mutajo, got a... No, Eddie Kayua. He got also one. So I drove mine back home with my fiancée. We went, the lady I married. So we went back home, parked the car. The following morning, I was summoned to... A car came to my home.
Mm-hmm.
I remember very well, UVS. State Research, they used to drive vehicles with number plate UVS. Mm-hmm. Uganda, very serious. You get it.
That's an interesting one. Uh-huh.
Nakasero. State Research.
Mm-hmm.
Now being asked how I won the rally. Can you imagine?
You won the rally?
I get there, they took me in a room. This guy started hitting me with these officers' sticks. Kauko. Eh? So Captain Smart said, I'm going to find a way of getting you out of this place, if you are lucky. But if I do, don't stay in Uganda. You have to leave.
What?
Mm. Did I ever go back? We dropped at cinema, meaning this Norman Cinema again, from Nakasero, down there to Kampala Road.
He dropped you?
Yeah. I went to Busi and, past, I went to Jinja, behind the, Panya Road.
Panya Road, not the main.
Close to Kenya.
You left your fiance behind? You didn't even go back home?
I didn't go back home.
When you entered Kenya, you found your way into Nairobi?
No, by that time I was married,
Mm.
So I left, with my two boys. I went to Kenya. Of course, you remember I had some trucks there.
Mm. You touched base with your contact.
So I started, proper transport. Now I started, again business. I moved to Kenya.
But you couldn't step inside here.
Yes. Mm. I think it was the 76 when I settled in Kenya. Exile. Then, of course, after... Okay, I built my... I registered a company. Intercontinental Transport. I happened to be in Intercontinental, sleeping in Intercontinental Hotel. So my lawyer asked me, which company?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want your company to be registered in? I just looked and I said,
Intercontinental,
because I was sleeping there. I said Intercontinental Transport Company Limited. So I started that company. I invited some few friends, one of whom I'm still with, Chris Kaiboke, then there was the late Agaba, Amos Agaba. Yeah, I was inviting people who had trucks. So I built my fleet to about 20 trucks.
Wow.
Then, of course, I ended up, I was very smart there again because I got to know Chris Kirubi, who was the general manager for Kinetico, government company.
Mm.
They had about 60 trucks, 70 trucks, which he gave me most of them, about 50. I had also multiple areas. They had about maybe 80. Coast Harriers. They had about also 100.
So
although,
you were riding,
you know, on the road, I found myself with a fleet of about maybe 200 to 250.
You were the biggest
transporter
at the time?
Yes.
And made your money?
Yeah, I made good money because this company that I was transporting for was based in Belgium, Antwerp.
Wow. Let's play your next song, Chairman.
All right.
When we return, then we'll have to understand from you, when you say, I made good money, what is good money? Is there bad money? I think something needs to be understood by especially our viewers and myself. So that will be your next song. Oh, yes. You did promise that you want to play Chameleon's song, Bariwa.
Bariwa, Bariwa.
Avakuvendere.
Avakuvendere, that's the song I like.
Do you love to dance? Yes, I know you said you don't like, you are not very well conversant with music, but do you love
to
dance?
I normally have parties at home.
Mm-hmm.
When I have family gathering on my birthday, Christmas. I was born on Christmas.
Interesting.
So we dance. And I like dancing with my grandchildren.
Now you have become a judge.
Yeah.
And they teach you the latest strokes around.
Of course.
Don't they almost
But sometimes I beat them. Don't
oh, really?
Joke.
That's
because
good.
I watch TV.
Let's play Bariwa by Jose Chameleon. This was chosen by Chairman Amazon Zay. When we return, it's more about his life story.
Desert Island Discs on 91.3 Capital FM.
Night 1.3 Capital FM, Desert Island Discs, and this is the story of Amos Nzei that we are going with. It is an incredible story. Typical move that describes grass to grace. So, here you are the biggest transporter in East Africa. It is the 70s, there is the war and turmoil in your motherland. You are in exile. Has your family joined you or they are still here in
Europe? No, they joined me. I brought them to Nairobi.
Nairobi.
Yes.
So now you were at least...
And in Nairobi, by the way, I also started some construction.
Mm-hmm.
So I built some small houses there.
For your own residential
I
or whatever?
Built,
or
for my first project, I built 4 houses, semi-detached. And I kept one, I rented the other, later on I sold. One of them I sold to Paul Echang.
Oh!
Honorable Paul Echang, my very good friend.
Oh, that's a very interesting
Yes,
one.
Very, very good friend. He's the godfather of my son.
Wow.
Arthur. And you know, that man, actually, he didn't need that house. He didn't need to buy. He bought by helping me to pay hospital bills for my son. My son fell sick.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and he was referred to Britain. And, you know, the treatment took a long time, 2 years, and then, of course, expenses.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to sell some of the properties to treat my son, which investment I can never regret.
But
I paid a lot of money.
That's what a parent does.
Every night was £279.
What?
Remember, the treatment is taking 2 years. I don't know how I managed to pay that money.
And the boy recovered his now.
And I got a contribution from these people in Antwerp, from Mr. Bicet, who was the managing, who was actually the son of the owner of the company. He gave me $100,000.
Wow.
Yes. I've made friends. I'm very good at making friends.
So, you are in Nairobi, but the fortunes in Uganda are changing. When do you return?
Okay, now from Nairobi, because of those circumstances that I've mentioned of my son falling sick. You know, in Nairobi they had given him 3 months. No more. Actually, when in Nairobi Hospital, the doctor, when he broke the news to me, we were 3 of us. A nursing sister, a doctor and myself. No, 4 of us. And my son was 5.5 years.
Oh.
And he said, this child of yours, can you believe he said he would die in less than 3 months?
That must
have broken
your heart.
This. And the nurse cried before me.
Oh dear.
The way he communicated that information. A 5.5 year child, you think
he understands.
Now I started negotiating to keep him in the hospital. He said, no, he has to go to Kenyatta Hospital. That's where we send them.
The ones we are...
Yes, and he said, no, it will not be wrong. You'll be there probably 1 month, 2 months. The longest will be 3 months. So I had to call a meeting of my friends. This being Dr. Rugunda, he was in exile, working in Kenyatta Hospital.
I had Dr. Mbonyo also in hospital. I had Dr. Kiyonga was in Katundu also in the hospital.
All those were your friends?
These were actually my comrades because we were also in the struggle together.
Absolutely, you were in the
and
struggle.
And probably these people, they went there for a purpose, to facilitate people in the bush. I don't know. Don't commit me on that, but I know.
Here we tell you a life story.
Maybe you can ask people like Charigonza, they could tell you.
I will ask
confirm.
When one of them sits there where you are seated,
yes.
I will ask them.
So, we had a meeting at Kenya, it's a Kenya professional club. It's a club in Kenya. So that's where we met for the meeting to decide the fate of my son. And I said, you know, this we involved the specialist of in cancer, Professor Kasirye at University of Nairobi. So he said, yes, there is treatment, but not in this country. One hospital is in America, and the other one, America is slightly cheaper, very expensive, but cheaper than Britain. In Britain, there is one known as the Great Ormond Street for the sick children. It's a hospital sponsored by the royal family, the Queen. They look after that hospital very, very well. I spent 2 years there, so I interacted with some of those, you know, financiers from the royal family. And that is where I was paying £279 a night.
So that meeting agreed, let's take the money.
They agreed. I called the Bunyenyezi, he gave me tickets, and we flew to Britain.
With the mother?
I think, yes. I think we arrived on 23rd of May, 1983. And I booked an apartment. There is a friend of mine called Jiwan, an Indian guy, a Ugandan who is in London. They were expelled from here by Amin. He was again introduced to me by Paul Etiang. So he met me at the airport in the morning at 6 a.m. Took me to apartment. We showered, then went to hospital. And we met there some very good doctors, Professor Chesos, Professor Hardes. They examined the boy and they said, this is curable. It's not what they had the organized in
That Arabic. Must have hit you like a wave of fresh air.
But of course they came with, you know, other, you know.
The cost.
When they take you through,
what
the child will go through, the medicines and so forth, and costs and so forth. So, I said, we go. We started treatment. And that now led me again to find something to do in the UK. I started now buying repudiated properties, renovating them, and selling them. I buy something at £60,000. I put in £20,000. I sell and I make my £30,000 to £40,000.
Human, do
you and
ever,
I did very well.
Do you ever get to a situation where you don't see a business opportunity?
So some of those who know me or knew me or visited the UK, I was not living badly. I was doing very well and at the same time treating my son. And that's how I managed it.
For two years.
You know, when I got involved in Pepsi, I cashed in all my properties, including the ones I had here.
Wow.
In Nakasera, I had about 6 houses in Nakasera. I sold all of them because of the demand of the investment.
Investment, yes.
Maybe we'll get to that.
Yeah, we certainly are getting there, without a doubt. Your life story is not one that we're going to just tell in one day. In fact, for today, we can now stop right here. We play your next song. Then when we return, which will be next Sunday, we continue with the life story.
Okay.
What would be your last song for today? What would be your last song for today?
The last song for today... This lady Kanyomozi.
Juliana.
I think she is talented. You know, she has some... She has some similarity with Whitney Houston.
How did you guess? You must then be a very good and avid musician.
Her voice.
Yes. And demeanor.
Yes.
If I may.
I normally insist that she attends, I mean, she plays on our functions.
Wow.
Sometimes my people let me down, but they normally invite her.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So what song of hers would you love us to play? Or can I choose for you a nice Juliana one?
Which one?
I will not tell it to you. You will just listen to it.
Okay. I'll listen to you.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
So it's this Islanders, and we've had part one of Chairman Amason Zeye's story. Like I say, when I have an incredible guest like this one, I don't shortchange you, our viewer or listener. We certainly put a pause to it and then return the subsequent Sunday for us to complete the story. And that's exactly what's going to happen this episode. We'll be right back next Sunday with yet the same guest sharing with us his life story.
Desert Island Discs.